other things in life besides gardens and pottery.
Welcome to Radio Free School.
Radio Free School visits with Dundas Potter Helen Brink.
I think I've made 11 weeks there, and I'm going to make 20 months.
I think I'll finish preparing the clay, though, and then you can see what happens here. I'm
going to get the balls so they'll be just about equal. They're 350 grams for big mugs. Just going to.
So nice and beautiful. You know, there's a little bit of clay in the river, right?
Do you?
It's in color, but.
It's beautiful.
Yeah. Yes, that's the most beautiful clay I've ever seen.
This is clay that comes from Alberta, actually. There's an old pottery business that used to make crocks, you know?
Like, where is one? There's one under there, one of those big stoneware crocks.
And I don't know whether they're still in business or not, but there's a lot of good clay in southern Alberta.
Mm. How about in Ontario?
In Ontario, it's earthenware clay. It's low firing. And in fact, when I was making earthenware, this is called stoneware, which is higher fired. But in Ontario, in southern Ontario, it's earthenware clay with a lot of iron in it. It's very red on the whole. Some of it's yellow. And when I first came to this part of the country, I was making pots with clay that was dug at the Foster Pottery for flower pots.
So there's a lot of measurement in clay that making. I can just see that you're
well. Really if you're doing a set, if you're doing things that you want to match, when I'm making say jugs that don't have to, you don't sell jugs in a set, then I don't bother measuring. Okay. I just do it by eye. And
so what is clay?
What is clay? Clay is the broken down rock, weathered by wind and water. Feldspathic rock, and then it gets mixed with a few other things, mainly with iron, and that's what gives this its dark colors, the iron in it. But pure feldspar is white or very light colored. And porcelain clay is white. You can tell, usually if you look at old houses, old brick houses in an area, you can see what color the clay has been around. There are some areas in Ontario where the brick houses are yellow. Have you seen yellow brick houses? In some areas up toward Lake Huron. North Goderich Way. All the houses are yellow brick. And when they got really fancy, some of them were bringing yellow clay brick to do the corners of their houses. Have you seen red brick houses with yellow corners and yellow patterns? Okay. That's what it is. What if I got 4, 5, 6? I need another one.
So how do you prepare the clay? Then you wedge it.
I wedge it, and then I get it now in almost ready to throw. I just have to wedge it a little bit. But when I was getting the clay from Foster Pottery and in Hamilton. I had to take the stones out.
Oh, right. Yes. Very rusty.
Yes. And had to really work it to. Sometimes it would be very dry, and you'd have to wet it down and get it in the right condition.
So you mean they would just get it out of the earth, and you had to deal with it?
Yes, that's right. That's right.
So I guess you buy from the place that has the better clay.
Well. I've got lazy. Most potters buy their clay in boxes.
As a potter, where's your body get the most workout? Like,
I'm very heavily developed across the shoulders and in the forearms. Look at the forearm on me. you'll see when I get at the wheel that I'm really using my. You almost use your whole body, but the part that gets to me, Randy, is the back.
The back, yeah.
Upper back. Because you're using all the muscles at the front, and the back doesn't get the same attention.
Can I touch one of those kennels?
You can touch them, but that's just when the clay is dry. It's very fragile. Easily broken, but that's before they're fired at all. Then they get fired once at a fairly low firing, and then you glaze them, and then you fire them to the higher temperature.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
But these are all dry. You can see these were small mugs that I made yesterday, and they're still too wet this morning because it's so damp. They're still too wet this morning to turn and put the handles on. That's what I thought I might be doing while you were here. But they're just too damp still.
There,
that's called the foot.
Mm-hmm. Oh, nice.
And so I do that, and then the handle goes on at the same time. Right now they distort too much. They're so soft.
Can I touch them?
Mm-hmm.
Or too much to ask?
Mm-hmm.
Something else.
See,
they're
quite wet.
Touch the stuff, right? So
yes, that's right.
Yeah. And the shapes and everything are so. What is there a stylistic sort of?
Well, I started with a Japanese potter many years ago in Toronto. She was a Japanese Canadian, but she was very influenced by Oriental styles.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to England, where Bernard Leach at the time was the guru, and he had learned his pottery in Japan and China. And he had lived in many years in Japan. So I am heavily influenced by Japanese and Chinese. I just like the form, and I paid a lot of attention to form. And there's a mirror right there, so I can see the profile of the pot.
What there for, yeah.
That's what that's there for. This way, if you're sitting at the wheel, you're looking down on the pot, more or less, and that lets you look at it from a completely different angle. I'm going to make a noise because this is a foot-fired wheel. That's a great big. That's actually cement. It's cement fondue.
Yeah.
cast cement fondue. So it's very heavy, got lots of weight to keep it going. But I'm lazy. I figure I can teach anybody to throw, but I am literally a hands-on teacher because I put my hands right over a student's hands and show them how much pressure it takes. Mm-hmm. And I've got my elbow on my hip and my elbow on my other hip, and then you've got a triangle, and I'm also on the edge of the wheel, which keeps you stable. Then you have to open it. And again, I've got my hands. My hands are working like a tool together.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
It didn't just happen.
How do you do that?
It's just skill, man.
How many do you do a day?
I confine myself to about 20 or 24 pots in a day. I don't. You can see I have other things to do. And occasionally there's I declare holiday and go to the garden, particularly planting time. I'm just in the garden, and then there are other things in life besides gardens and pottery.
I'm interested in the tools too because they're so basic. And
yes, story about Hamada, who was a Japanese potter, and he was doing a workshop in the United States, and he was decorating pots, and he had a brush that he was using, and one of the students said, "Oh, well, it's easy for you because you have such wonderful brushes." And Hamada said nothing. He walked out a door, came back with a handful of grass, bound it together, and decorated a pot. Make it a little wider. That's pressing out from the inside.
You are listening to Radio Free School on CFMU.
It's funny that always the first one you throw to is not as good as the ones that come afterward.
Oh, yeah.
Even though you're throwing all the time, the first one, then you get into a rhythm.
So just a straight pin?
It's a corsage pin.
So these are your own invented tools then?
Well, some people use various things. I have... you can do it with a wire too. Yeah. These are special twisted wires. You use all kinds of funny things. those are
dentist tools.
I think I have a toothbrush in there somewhere.
Wow.
I've got a lot of stamps, but I go back and use the same one again and again and again. My favorite is that one. It's been dropped several times, but it's the spiral. Yeah. There's just something really special about a spiral.
Yes, I love spirals. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I had never seen a potter throw until I was sort of semi-retired from nursing and doing a job that was more or less a social work job and living under the same roof, and I was not getting out very much. My assistant, who was much older than me, had taught in the Japanese internment camps, in BC. And one of her former students was teaching pottery, and she was going to go to these pottery classes. So my husband said, why don't you go too and get out of the house? And I did, and I've never looked back. You know, I just couldn't resist it. Mm-hmm. I like tools. I like basic things. Mm-hmm. And I guess that I get come by it honestly. My one great-grandfather was a shoemaker, and the other one was a master blacksmith. I've always done crafts of various sorts, but pottery, I had no idea that I could do it or even how it was done.
Yeah. Would you say that pottery has always been, it's been with humanity forever?
Yes, probably came about inadvertently. One explanation is that it was used in baskets to make them more or less waterproof, and then some a basket would get in the fire somehow, and then the clay liner would survive, but the basket wouldn't. But the other thing is that people modeled fertility figures, mm-hmm. and I don't know how they came to fire them, but I guess they were drying around the campfire and got in the fire. But once they're fired, they're there for a long time, mm-hmm. until they're ground.
The thing about pottery, right, because it's almost the utility of it and then the artistic, right, so you said the fertility figurines, which are more ritualistic and artistic, and then the usefulness of a basket.
Yes.
That sort of seems elemental to the pottery. Eh?
That's right. Mm. But they, even the useful things were decorated very, very early, and I think you could almost say that fertility figures were utilitarian.
Right, that's a good point.
And very, very early, the idea of decorating pots came about. I was fascinated a long time ago when we were in Italy. We were in the Florence Museum, the Museo Archaeologico, and there was hardly been anybody in the museum, and we were sort of alone up on the top floor. And I was just taken by the Etruscan pots, which are black. They're called bucaro, and they were blackened in the fire, quite low fired. But the decorations were very interesting. They had what are called meanders, like a Greek key kind of thing around them. And a lot of them had what looked like a Greek key but was not complete. And I started looking at these things, and I realized that they were male and female. Mm-hmm. They were male and female figures, that the large one was a male and the small one was a female. They would be seated. They were seated figures. And there were hands, there were extra pieces that stuck out, hands that did various things. Some of them were holding hands or reaching out toward one another. Some of them were not reaching out toward one another. And then there was one where they were actually back to back, as though we're mad at each other, we're not talking. And I don't think anybody's ever seen that. I did write an article on it a long time ago for a pottery magazine that now has ceased to be. I don't think anybody has really noticed that. The decorations, a lot of them had meaning.
If you don't have a kiln and you wanted to fire something, could you do it out? Did you?
You can
you
with
pit fire. And
you can do a pit fire. You get a very probably a very soft product. It wouldn't hold water. It would be, it would, the water would seep through. It would hold water briefly, but then it's likely to disintegrate if it isn't fired, if the clay isn't fired to its maturity. So that, but it's certainly possible. You have to be careful that your pot is very dry and that the temperature doesn't change too fast, because you might get them exploding. The water in the pot will change to steam and just explode your pot. Then there's not only the physical water, but there's the chemically bound water, which goes off at a slightly higher temperature. And when I fire, you can always smell the kiln because it steams. There's a certain amount of steam going off. Some of the volatile things can go off, and if there's any sulfur in the clay, it's sulfurous. Okay. But as long as you don't shock the pot too much, you can do an outdoor firing. In fact, there are parts of Africa where they fire really quite fast, just throwing on grass. I am a great fan of a potter now dead called Michael Cardew, who worked in Ghana for a number of years. Wonderful potters that used coiling to make great big pots.
I've seen those, yeah. Really tall.
Huge pots, and some of them they actually will coil a granary. I don't think they fire them, but they actually coil the building. He brought a marvelous potter to England while we were living there, named Ladi Kwali, who was just superb at the making, but also the decorating. Wonderful decorating. He went to help with technical problems, getting them to do higher fired pots, using local materials. He was, I don't know whether he was trained as a geologist or not, but he certainly knew a lot of geology and was able to work on the chemical nature of the clays and of the glaze materials using local things. Trying to get them to make pots that were marketable outside their own local area.
You are listening to Radio Free School on CFMU.
Pottery, you know, is very close to glass. Glass is made from silica, which is the little glassy bits of sand, you know. Have you seen? It's silica sand. If you look at sand very carefully, if you look at it under a magnifying glass, you'll see that some are like little tiny pieces of glass. They melt at very high temperatures, and that's how glass is made. Well, similar with the glazes. They're made from a number of things. They're made from various rocks, but also silica. So it's a glassy thing, but you have to put it on. You mix these in water. It's ground very, very finely, mixed in water, and it'll settle to the bottom of your bucket. But if you stir it hard, keep it. It's called in suspension. Then if you dip the pot, which is fired once, it's like brick, sort of soft and like brick. If you put your tongue on it, you get a wet spot, and then the wet spot dries right away. That's the way the clay is when you glaze. When it's like brick, you dip it in the bucket of glaze and quickly set it down and touch up the spots where your fingers were, and then all that wet goes into the pot and leaves the
the dry stuff on the surface. You have to be careful that you wipe it off the foot of the pot, because if you didn't, when you put it in the kiln, it would stick to the shelf in the kiln. But then you have to fire it once it's dry, and you have lots of pots to fill the kiln. Fire it up to a very high temperature.
How many degrees?
Fahrenheit, it's about, what's called cone 10, it's about 2,280 degrees. That's almost white heat. Fahrenheit, that's what, something like 1,800 degrees Celsius. I don't like using electricity for environmental reasons, and I pack a very tight kiln. So I get everything into it that I possibly can.
What other kilns can you use then? I'm just wondering.
Well, I have a propane gas fired kiln.
Oh. Wow.
This was to be my wonderful kiln that I was going to be easier on the environment. I have to say that I feel very guilty about using energy, and I sometimes think, well, I shouldn't be doing it.
Okay.
But this is the kiln, and it's made with that's fire brick, very high firing brick, and these are very high fired. It's called silicon carbide shelves. That one's just a clay shelf, high fired clay, and these are this is the way I can tell temperatures. See, there are a whole lot of little cones that I put into clay, and they melt at different temperatures.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is this dark one at the front, a little basin for it to melt into. And then I watch them through a hole in the side of the kiln. But when it gets to the really high temperatures, they're very hard to see.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the last time I slightly underfired the kiln because I could not see the cone. You're supposed to wear goggles, like a welder wears goggles. Sometimes you cheat and you take them off because you can't see.
Mm-hmm.
It's so difficult. In order to get certain glaze effects, you have to have what's called a reducing fire, a smoky fire, because the glazes change color according to whether or not there's oxygen in the kiln or not. And that, you can see the difference in color of the clay. This one is reduced, this one is oxidized.
I just wanted to ask, just to round the whole thing from beginning to end, like, what do you do, where do you sell, like, or what do you market?
Mainly the studio tour. This is my last year in the studio tour. This year, that's the 1st and 2nd of October.
Mm.
That's for 2 days, and that is a lot of pots move on that occasion. Then there's the Hamilton Potters Guild sale, 3 days, spring and fall, in Dundas. I have things in the Carnegie Gallery and in the McDonald Stewart Gallery in Guelph. But that's all I do now. Time was when there used to be a potter's, Ontario Potter's shop in Toronto on Yorkville. I had things there, but that's a big hassle, you know. I really want to do things locally.
Yeah.
I think that things should. I don't want to see the same thing coast to coast. I want to see things here that came, you know, you can say, this says Dundas.
Yeah.
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 And even like I'm sure how you decorate your art, I'm sure you get influenced by the natural.
Absolutely.
Like nature around you.
Absolutely.
That's really specific to this area. Beautiful design there.
In the spring, I'm pruning apple trees and pear trees, mm-hmm. and I've got apples on my. Yeah. That's one of my favorite designs now, putting on apples and pears.
Yeah.
And occasionally, I get around to doing things like grapes on big plates.
I'm gonna wrap myself in paper. I'm gonna daub myself with glue. Stick some stamps on the top of my head. I'm gonna mail myself to you.
Contact Radio Free School at grassroots@hwcn.org or mail P.O. Box 19, 1280 Main Street West, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, L8S1CO.